Evidence and Answers begins right now. This is Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. For over a century, the archaeology of Jericho has fueled intense debate over the biblical account of Joshua's conquest. In this episode, archaeologist Brian Wendell traces the excavations from John Garstang to today and reveals fresh evidence suggesting Jericho City 5 aligns remarkably well with the biblical timeline of occupation, fortification, and destruction. If you've missed any part of this broadcast, log on at evidenceandanswers.org and there you will find this discussion entitled Jericho, Recent Discoveries from Modern Excavations. And you'll also find hundreds more podcasts that you may download or listen online. Now let's get right into part two of this fascinating topic.
The way that I describe it to people is I love food. I love chocolate cake. And I love those like layered chocolate cakes with lots of layers in them. If you think of these mounds in Israel, they're kind of like a chocolate cake. They've got different layers, one on top of the other. And the earliest layers are at the bottom. And then that city was destroyed. And usually people would build in the same place because there was some advantage there. And at Jericho, the advantage is that right at the base of this particular hill where they built the city is this great spring that still to this day gushes forth water. And so when you've got a spring right beside your city, in fact, during the late Bronze Age time of Joshua and many of the other periods, they actually built the city wall around the spring so that their water source was protected. And so at Jericho, because it's got this great water source with lots of water that continually pumps water out, they would build these cities. So you would have the earliest city, I think, that they have found, we call it the pre-pottery Neolithic, right? The very earliest evidence of a material culture. And then, you know, the next city was built on top of that because each of these cities were often destroyed. Sometimes they were destroyed by earthquakes because that area is an area where there's a fault line. Other times it was a foreign people group coming in and destroying it. Often the destruction's attributed to the Egyptians coming into the land because they would come up at different times. And so you have these different cities, one on top of the other. Early Bronze Age city, sometime around, 2500 BC, 3000 BC, that's when early Bronze Age would be. And then you've got the middle Bronze Age on top of that. And each of these different ages are often broken into subgroupings. And so you've got these different cities. So City 4, for example, according to the latest stratigraphy, has 5 different occupational levels associated with this over a period of almost 450 years. And so you've got these cities built one on top of each other, the early Bronze Age cities, then the middle Bronze, then the late Bronze, then the Iron Age. And quite often they would just scrape the tell clean, the mound, they would scrape it clean. And then they built right on top of what was there before. They would fill in to make things level. So as archaeologists, we come along, we dig through each layer successively going down, trying to get to the earliest one. And that's how these layers are. And each of those layers is given a stratum number, or in the case of Jericho, we just call it city 4 or city 5 or stratum 4, stratum 5. That's how it works.
Yes. And so archaeologists were looking at city 4 or level 4. And what you're saying is that Jericho was, at level 5 or Jericho City 5 was occupied during the time of Joshua's conquest. So briefly, just take us through the timeline of the conquest and what evidence you've got that City 5 was indeed occupied when Joshua arrived there at Jericho.
Yes. So the first part of that, Pat, is to figure out what point in history are we looking? What are the dates that we're looking within? Because if you look at the wrong time, you're not going to find the right evidence. And so most of us, we start when we talk about the conquest, or the Exodus, because they're kind of tied. We go to 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1. And in 1 Kings 6, 1, we read this. In the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord. Now, if we can figure out when that anchor date is of the fourth year of Solomon's reign, when he began building the temple, then it's a simple mathematical calculation. If you take these numbers in a straightforward, literal manner, as I do, because it was in the 480th year, you count back 479 years. And so many people would place the fourth year of Solomon's reign around 967. So you backtrack 479 years, you get to 1446 for the Exodus. And then, of course, they wandered for 40 years. So that would bring the conquest date, which is the period that I'm focused on, to about 1406. But here's the problem. Some people get so focused on a particular year. I know one scholar has even tried to pinpoint the exact day. The problem with that is that assumes, first of all, that your anchor date is right. And so we have different people who say it's for 967. Edwin Tilley, the great scholar who did a lot of work in chronology, he said it was 967. Kenyon said it was 960. Albright said it was 959. So we have, you know, I would say it's probably closer to the 966, 967, but I don't know that you can pinpoint an exact year, much less a day. But then there's another problem, and that is that the verse reads differently in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation that actually predates the Masoretic text that our English translations are built on and or are translated from. And so in the Septuagint, it doesn't say in the 480th year, it says in the 440th year. Well, that means if that is the correct reading in the original, that was the original reading that was in the Book of Kings, then that would mean the conquest was a difference of 40 years. So it would be 1366. So I've got these two dates then. I've got 1406, if the Masoretic text is correct. I've got 1366, if the Septuagint is correct. Essentially, in my mind, and I've investigated this, and I can't tell which is the original. I just can't. There's good evidence on both sides. And so I have essentially two viable biblical dates for the Exodus. And then I have the second issue, which is when it comes to chronology, when it comes to dating things as archaeologists, it's not like we primarily date things based on the pottery. Different pottery changes over periods of time. But even at that, it's not like all of the potters woke up at 1400 BC, January 1st, 1400 BC, and said, all right, everybody, we're changing the pottery styles today. We're changing the pottery decorations today. And so there's a nice clean break like that. They changed over time and in different areas. And so to even speak so rigidly of something that is LB1B or LB2A is even not really accurate from a pottery point of view. In fact, I've been in communication throughout my master's thesis with Dr. Robert Mullins, who is the world's leading authority on late Bronze Age pottery. He literally wrote the chapter on it in the book that we all use of ceramic typology, the latest book on ceramic typology, the ancient pottery of Israel and its neighbors, the late Bronze Age chapter. And so he uses the term LB1B, LB2A horizon. There's this horizon of stuff. If you think of carbon 14 dating that we do, again, you get a date range. You don't get a specific year. And even the Egyptian chronology, which is what the late Bronze Age pottery is all tied to, or the late Bronze Age dating is tied to, even Egyptian chronology, we can't agree on when pharaohs even reigned. It depends whether you take the high chronology or the low chronology or the mid chronology. And some people have a radical chronology that's off by hundreds of years. And so most Egyptologists would admit there's a two decade plus or minus margin of error in Egyptian chronology at this particular period of time. So here's what I did for my thesis. I've got these two dates, 1406, 1366. I take a plus or minus 20-year margin of error window on either side of that, which gives me an 80-year range from 1426 BC to 1346 BC, 80 years that I'm pretty confident the conquest occurred sometime within that 80-year period. And for people who want to pinpoint a specific year, I just see there's too much ambiguity surrounding the text and archaeological dating methods for me to actually go to a single year. And I think, you know what, from an archaeological perspective, if you can nail this down to within an 80-year period, that's pretty good when we're going back 3,400 years. And so I look in that 80-year window and I go, okay, what evidence is there within that window, which is the time Jericho City 5 existed? What archaeological evidence do we have that might align with the biblical description of occupation, fortification, and destruction?
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, 50 to 100-year window, when you're talking thousands of years, I mean, that's nothing in archaeology. You know, we try to think, well, unless I can get it on the dot, it's not historically accurate. Well, when you're talking thousands of years here, a gap of 50 or 100 years, I mean, that's pretty accurate when you're talking thousands of years here. So really, that doesn't, you know, it's not a blow against the historical reliability of the Bible. That's actually pretty good if you can get it in that window.
Yeah. And I'm trying to be honest with the data. And I know some people have pushed back against me saying, no, you should decide which of those two is correct, the Masoretic text or the Septuagint, and you should push for a single year. And I know our modern minds think like that. Mm-hmm. But in the ancient world, they didn't so much think like that. And when we're dealing with archaeological things from thousands of years ago, over three millennia ago, we just don't get that. And that's just the reality of what we're dealing with.
Yeah. So what evidence did we find, Brian, that Jericho City 5 was occupied as the Bible states, or, you know, as the text states, there was a fortified city there?
Yeah. So let's talk about the occupation first. So what evidence do we have that the city was occupied? First of all, and I'll go through a number of lines of evidence. First of all, there's pottery that was found on the tell itself. So this is in the excavations on the tell in late Bronze Age areas. And so what I did was I went through all of the excavation reports. I had a Google Earth image of Jericho, and I knew where the different excavations areas were. And I plotted all of the areas where they found late Bronze Age pottery. And they found late Bronze Age pottery in seven different areas around the tell, but primarily in an eighth area right on the top of the tell in an area called Spring Hill. And Spring Hill, as the name suggests, is the hill that is at the top of the tell that overlooks, it's kind of on the eastern side of the tell that overlooks the spring. And that was where the royalty or the people who were ruling, they built their palaces. So the early Bronze Palace was there, and then the middle Bronze Palace was there. And then there's a late Bronze Age structure that's a little smaller. Garstang called it his middle building because it was between the middle Bronze Age palace and the Iron Age palace, or the Hellani, we call it, because that's a style of palace in the middle in the Iron Age. And so right in that area, they have found all sorts of pottery. Every single team that is excavated there, Selenum Watzinger, Garstang, Kenyon has published pottery from there that's from the late Bronze Age. And Negro, frustratingly, has only published one sherd so far that I have seen that he has published, but it's a piece of a Cypriot milk bowl that dates to the late Bronze Age. And so every single team has found late Bronze Age pottery on the tell. And much of it is painted. Some of it is monochrome and some of it is duochrome. And so sometimes people say, well, how can you tell whether that's late Bronze Age? You can tell based on a number of factors. You can tell based on the clay itself, how well fired it is, whether it's very fine clay or there's lots of inclusions in it. You can tell by the forms, although many of the forms in the late Bronze Age continue from the middle Bronze Age. So where do they fit in there? Although there are a couple of forms that are unique to the late Bronze Age, but then painting is one of the key ways that we can tell. Oftentimes, if you see two lines that are vertical with a squiggle in between, you're looking at late Bronze Age pottery there. And they've all found late Bronze Age pottery on the tell. I've mentioned that Kenyon excavated a house on the tell, just a little, I believe, to the north of the site where the palaces were. And she found a dipper juglet there. So there's pottery also from the tombs. And so while the city was destroyed itself by Joshua, it doesn't appear that the tombs were, the necropolis was northwest of the city. And Garstang excavated three tombs that had late Bronze Age vessels in it, whole vessels. And so tomb four, it appears, was used sometime between about 1400 and 1300 BC, maybe a little earlier. Tomb five was used earlier, about 1450 BC to 1300 BC. Tomb 13 was used from about 1400 to, some would even say, 1275 BC in that area. And all of them have clear evidence of late Bronze Age pottery. And then you've got the architecture. In addition to Kenyon's house, probably the most significant structure excavated on the Tell is called the Middle Building. That's what Garstang called it. And it's right where the palaces stood. In fact, Negro, the current excavator, suggests this structure, even though it was smaller, functioned as a palace on a reduced scale. He calls it the residency. That's what he calls it. And Garstang originally dated it to the 15th century BC, and he associated it with City 4. But then, based on some dating of this painted pottery, he realized and he changed his mind. He said this actually comes from LB2, so from the 14th century. But that put him into a bit of a pickle, because he's got City 4 that he dates earlier. And so what he did was he disassociated the middle building from City 4. And he put it to a later period of time in the 14th century that he associated with Eglon, king of Moab, who we're told occupied the site for a brief period of time. Kenyon actually dated the structure to the LB2A period. Bienkowski, who also did a study, looked and he said LB2A to early LB2B. And Negro has suggested there are two phases, I believe. He calls it City 5-1 and City 5-2. And so, but it's not really clear whether he sees two phases in that middle building or not. And if he does, my explanation for that, Pat, would be that the first phase in LB2A, the 14th century occupation, is the king of Jericho that Joshua conquered. And then, you know, after it was destroyed, apparently Eglon came in and took over for a period of time in the Judges. Remember, the Israelites kept getting oppressed, and that 13th century occupation should be associated probably with Eglon. That's how I would explain that. So there's architecture that dates to City 5. There are scarabs. Scarabs are these little amulets that are in the shape of a dung beetle, and they were highly collectible. And they have found the seal with the throne name of Thutmosis III on it, and then a scarab of Hatshepsut, the female pharaoh, and then a scarab of Amenhotep III. And to me, the key one is that scarab of Amenhotep III, because he is the third in this sequence of pharaohs that reigned from sometime in the 1400s through to the early 1300s. And so it doesn't matter whether the reason I choose the scarab of Amenhotep III, because he was an LB2A, a 14th century pharaoh, and it was found in a tomb amidst LB2A 14th century artifacts. So that helps us to date it. And it doesn't matter how you date it, whether you use the high chronology. Amenhotep III is said to have lived from 1401 to 1364 BC. Or the low chronology, the 1390 to the 1352 BC, doesn't matter which you choose, both are within my chronological window. Mm-hmm. And so the scarabs say that it was actually, there were people there using the tombs during that period. And then there was a cuneiform tablet that was discovered just to the east, just outside of the middle building. Garstang found it. He described it as most similar to the Tell el Amarna tablets, and he dated it to the 14th century BC. Now, I don't know how familiar your listeners will be to the Amarna tablets, but they are these letters from that were sent to the Pharaoh of Egypt by kings all throughout the ancient Near East, but there's a whole group of them from the kings of Canaan, because at that time, Egypt controlled the Canaanite city-states, and so the kings would write letters to the Pharaoh. And it's quite humorous to read them, because they're constantly, you know, I am the dirt beneath your feet. I lie down seven times on my face. I turn over back and forth seven times. Like, it's quite funny to hear that the kings of the city states, you know, talk to the Pharaoh. Well, this tablet, if it's an Amarna tablet and if it dates to the 14th century, again, indicates the occupation. But more than that, Negro says this. He says that this tablet suggests the city had a political role, a palace, a ruler, and even an archive in the 14th century. Well, that sounds pretty similar to the city of Jericho that we see described in the Bible. So when you put all of these things together, the pottery from the tell, from the tombs, the architecture, the scarabs, the cuneiform tablet, it is clear that Jericho was occupied within my chronological window for the conquest.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And the Bible describes Jericho as a city with high walls, that it was a fortified city. So if it was destroyed 100 years before when the city was rebuilt, what evidence do we have that indeed it was a another fortress city?
Well, and that's a good point, Pat, because there are some people who look at Jericho. In fact, there's an outdated view that at the collapse of the Middle Bronze Age, when cities started to be rebuilt in the Late Bronze Age, they were not fortified. That's kind of the old fashioned view, although it's based on some outdated evidence. In fact, I cite in my book and in my thesis some work by Hansen, who shows that the vast majority of Late Bronze Age cities mentioned in the book of Joshua and Judges that are specifically said to be fortified, there's actually evidence of them being fortified in the Late Bronze Age. So here's what the people, it seems, they often did. They would often, when they resettled a site and rebuilt the city, they would reuse the fortifications of the Middle Bronze Age. So if you go to Jericho today, or if you look at any pictures online, at the southern part of the tell, southern part of the city, they have exposed, they've excavated this curving stone wall. They call it the Cyclopean Wall because I guess it got that title because people thought the stones were so big, only a cyclops could have put them in place there. That's kind of how we get that term. And so, but that wall, that stone wall was built in the Middle Bronze Age. That was built 150 years before Joshua came along. But then when they rebuilt the city that Joshua conquered, they put a new brick wall, a new brick superstructure on top of the stone wall. And so when the Bible talks about the walls of Jericho falling, it's not the stone wall that fell, it's the mud bricks that were on top of it that would have fallen. And so when we look at the latest research by Negro's team, and they have excavated another portion of that stone wall, that stone cyclopean revetment wall at the southern part of the tell, and he says that the residents of Jericho rebuilt this fortification on top of it. In fact, their investigations show that the mud brick wall that they built was about 2 meters wide and that it was moved back about 20 to 30 centimeters just from the front face of the stone cyclopean wall, and it went up from there. And so the latest evidence from Jericho seems to suggest that, yes, it was fortified at the time the Bible indicates. In fact, this is really helpful, because that stone cyclopean wall has been found by many of the teams in areas almost all the way around the city, not quite so much on the eastern side. And so that allows us then, if that was where they put the city walls, was these mud brick walls on top of the cyclopean wall, we now know how big the Late Bronze Age city of Jericho was. And it would have been about 4.5 hectares or 11 acres in size. Now, for comparison, Hazor was 84 hectares, 207 acres in size. Megiddo, 20 hectares, 49 acres in size. So what I'm saying is this: Jericho in our minds has taken on mythical proportions in terms of size. People think it's huge. In fact, some of the diagrams, some of the children's drawings I've seen have these massive walls and this massive city. The reality archaeologically is that Jericho was not a very large city. It was likely a couple thousand people, and it was 4.5 hectares in size, but it was fortified, and it had a palace, and it had a king, and the things that the Bible seems to indicate. But we need to kind of, sometimes what we do when we come to the biblical text is we read into it.
Once again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586. Or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.